Alcohol Name Lee. Sobriety date is August 23rd, 2001. My home group is Speaking of Step group by Alcoholics Anonymous that meets at Forest Hill Presbyterian Church on Sunday at 6:30. We also have a beginners meeting on Wednesday at 8 p.m. If you're ever in Richmond, stop in and see us. We'd be glad to have you there. You know, I'm available to sponsor guys. I have one sponsor each, but I tell them I can't find them with a search one sometimes. So, you know, but, you know, and I have a sponsor, you know, and he's been my sponsor for at least 22 years, I think it is, 23 years. We stay in constant contact with each other. You know, my story, I guess, you know, I took my first drink when I was 7 years old. And always wanted to be, you know, the grown up, you know. I come from a big family. I had seven brothers and three sisters. My dad was in the military. My mom was a nurse. My dad was always gone. He fought in quite a few wars. His last one was the Vietnam War he was in. He was in for 33 years. And, you know, he taught me a lot of, he taught me how to fish, hunt, all that stuff like that when he was home. But me, you know, I'd never felt, you know, even with all those brothers, you know, I'd never felt like I belonged, you know. Always played by myself, you know. I like to go in the woods and hang out in the woods and catch frogs and tadpoles and stuff like that, you know. And, you know, I did it on the way to school too, you know. So my mom would send me out in clean clothes, and I'll get to school, my shirt and my shoes all muddy and everything, you know. And the teacher was like, "Now, I know your mom didn't send you out like that." And, you know, I said, "Hey, I just stopped by the pond." And, you know, I tell people I got held back when I was in the second grade, you know. Always tried to impress the young ladies in first grade and second grade. You know, I stole money out the teacher's purse, you know. Not one time, not two times, not three times, but several times. $5, you know, $5 here, $5 there. And I went in there one day, and she didn't have $5 in there. She had 20s. So I told her, so I stole the 20. After lunch, one of the kids says, "Whose mommy is that?" And I looked at it, it was my mom. The teacher called my mom and told her what had happened. And they took me down to the principal's office. And, you know, I had to confess that, yeah, I did it, you know. And my consequences was I get held back. So I got held back for a year with this same teacher. Of course, I didn't steal from her again. So, you know, she was happy about that. Yeah. But I tell people I was a little hairy in school, man, because I did all kind of crazy stuff, man. I really did, you know. I always wanted something for nothing. I remember, you know, one night I was watching the John Wayne movie, the CBs. And, you know, I was always, I love war movies. So we were playing there, me and my cousin, me and my best friend, his brother and my brother, we were playing war, and they built a camp out of, they dug a foxhole, and they made it out of corrugated steel. We had a cardboard box. We couldn't get them out that daggone foxhole for nothing. You know, we're throwing dirt bombs and loading it up, and they just laughing at us. Me, I just watched the CB, so I got an answer. You know, I told Chuck, I said, "Man, I can get them out of there." And he said, "How?" and I pulled the matches out of my pocket and I lit a match and I set the field on fire. They came out of there, all right. You know, and we ran because it really got out of hand. It was just it was a big field and it was blazing. So we had to run in the house and call the fire department. I'm always thinking ahead. I went and got my mom's ashtray and I poured it right down where it hadn't burned yet. And when the fire department got there, we came up with a lie that there was a car parked there and it looked like somebody dumped the ashtray. And they looked and they seen the butts and said, yep, there's some cigarette butts. So, you know, we got away with that. You know, I told my mom probably about 10 years. I was in high school when I told my mom I had done that. You know, but yeah, man, that the drinking, you know, like I said, 7 years old, I was up in D.C. at family reunion, and they were playing, my aunts and my uncles and my mom, my dad, they were out there playing cards, and they were having fun. They were laughing and slapping cards, and my aunt came in, and she got a drink of old granddad. She went up in the cabinet. So I got a chair and I went up in there and I went up in the cabinet and I got me a drink of old granddad. But old granddad was a little bit too hot. When I took it down, it burnt my chest. So I put water in it. And my brother went and told my aunt that he's got a bottle, a glass of wine, a glass of liquor. And she came in and she found it. She grabbed me by the hand, she poured the water down liquor out, grabbed a bottle and took it outside and poured a shot, and she said, drink. And every time I didn't drink, I got a smack. You know, I didn't look at that as being child abuse. It was just trying to teach me a lesson. You know, I didn't take another drink till I was 17 years old. Actually, 15, I'm sorry. I had just gotten up to, I got up to the high school. I got in the ninth grade, and I was like, okay. Me and my buddy, we just finished football practice and we went and got a quarter country club. That joker went down so nice, man. After practice, it was, yeah. And, yeah, you know, but nothing really came with that. You know, I playing football, I decided that I wouldn't drink and do other substances while I'm playing football. And I didn't, you know, during the season. Now, after the season was a different story, you know, a lot of beer, a lot of what I thought was wine, but it was something that somebody made up in a science fair. They called it Thunderbird, Night Train, and all that stuff like that. There was no wine. Like my sponsor always told me, there was no grapes in that. You know? So, you know, I drank a lot of that stuff, man. And, I didn't know that I was becoming a budding alcoholic by drinking that. And you know, after high school, man, I got a scholarship to go play football in North Carolina at one of the small universities there. And I could have went to Virginia State, which is right down the street from me. You know, that's where my mom wanted me to go. She said, you know, it'll be good for you to stay home, you know. And I decided it wouldn't be good for me to stay home because you guys would be seeing everything that I did. So it's time for me to move on. And, you know, y'all won't be able to tell. You're 7 hours away. You won't be able to tell what I was doing, you know. So I took myself and my disease down there to Charlotte, North Carolina, with the same thinking that I wouldn't drink during the season. That went along pretty good until my junior year. You know, we had a game on Thanksgiving Day. No, we had a game the day after Thanksgiving or the Saturday after Thanksgiving. So we had to stay there. And me and my buddy, me and the teammates, we decided to play a little drinking game called 99. And I've won 99 so much, man, that I just figured I was going to win this time. And I didn't. I woke up Friday morning And I was, you know, feeling real bad. And I asked my roommate, how did I get here? And he said, we brought you here and we carried you. You know, sometime during the night, I blacked out. You know, I got so drunk, I blacked out. And I get a shower. I go into the cafeteria to eat lunch because the bus was waiting for us because we had a game in Raleigh. And I go in there and I get my tray. And one of my buddies that was there with me, he said, man, you getting ready to throw up. And I said, what? He said, you getting ready to throw up. Before I could say, no, I'm not. All in my tray. You know. We leave campus. We get on the bus. We leave campus. And we get up to Raleigh and we're doing walkthroughs, you know. And the coach come in the huddle and he asks, who is that? And everybody looked at me. And he asked me, he said, son, you going to be all right? All that alcohol was coming out of my pores, you know, and it was no mistaking, you know. So, of course, we got our tail whooped pretty good that, you know, none of us was serious about playing that game anyway, but we got our tail whooped. Then I decided in the spring, after spring practice, I decided that, okay, I don't need to go to none of my coaches' classes. They're going to pass me anyway. So, you know, if it was math or English, you know, non-coach, I went to your class, you know. Anything else, if you were coaching, you were teaching, I didn't go to your class because you're not going to fail me. And one of the coaches failed me. So he's saying, you got to go to summer school. Nope, not going. First semester of summer school, I didn't go. You know, the head coach said, look, you got to go to summer school. I'm not going, coach. You need to get him changed grade. He said, you need to go to summer school. So I'm not going. So stubborn me, didn't go first semester. Second semester, you know, I seen the coach and I was talking to him. He said, man, look, I need you to go to summer school. I said, coach, it's not going to happen. I said, you need to get him to change the grade. Me and my buddy Kenny was riding downtown Charlotte and we seen the military recruiting station. I went in and I took the test, you know, and I could have joined any service that I wanted to join because I passed the test for everybody. I chose to go in the Navy. And talking to the recruiter, I told him, yep, you know, he had already set the date, August. You know, I was leaving in August. So I go back to campus, man, and I see Coach Harris, and I say, yeah, Coach, I got some news for you, man. He said, man, I got some news for you. And I said, what's that? He said, Coach Lyde changed the grade. I said, it's too late, Coach. He said, what do you mean? I said, I joined the Navy. And he told me, he said, son, you're not ready for that. You're really not ready for that. He said, you can get out of that. And I said, no, I'm going to go ahead and join the Navy. So I joined the Navy. And needless to tell you, he was right. I wasn't ready for that. Finished boot camp. Went to A school. You know, when I was in boot camp, man, I wanted to be either a dental tech or a hospital corpsman. Those are the only two things that I had picked. And my petty officer came by and he was like, man, you got to have three. I said, I don't know. So he said, just pick that right there, which was CT, cryptology. And he said, you probably won't get it. So I put it down there, and sure enough, that's what I got, cryptology. And to make it bad, it was cryptology, CTA. That means administration. I couldn't type two words, but that's what you had to do, and I had to learn to type. So, you know, that was rough in A school, learning to type, you know, but I got up to probably about 24 words a minute, know. And still, that wasn't fast enough for, you know, what I was supposed to have been doing, in the Navy. So finished A school, man, and now it's time to, you know, pick a duty station. I picked a duty station in Norfolk. Again, the Navy had a different idea. They sent me to London. I was like, man, I came home for 30 days and I told my mom, see, they sent me to London, Mom. So I'm going to London on staff duty, man. And I take my disease with me. You know, now I can drink like a sailor. Okay. And I did. I get to London, you know, find people that were just like me, man, except those people did other substances too. They, you know, smoked marijuana also. And that was right up my alley. So I did 3 years over there. Well, let me back up for a minute. My first year there, you know, everything was cool. My second year, my alcoholism caught up with me, but I wouldn't tell you that my alcoholism caught up with me. Everybody had a duty. There was like 12 of us, petty officer, third class, second class, first class, chief petty officer, master chief, senior chiefs. And we had duties. And you had to be up, you know, I had to be up by 4 o'clock to get into work by 5, pick up all the messages, sort them, and get them to the people that's supposed to be getting them. Well, the first time I was late, they let me go. You know, I was late. I come in at 7 o'clock. And they asked me what was going on, and I said, oh, my alarm clock didn't go off. Okay. And after the fourth time, my alarm clock not going off. Okay, we need to take a look. What's going on? Nothing. You know, are you hanging down the main brace, which that's where we go to drink? And I said, no, just, you know, just overslept. And they, the fifth time I went to XO Mass, and I still got a slap on the wrist. The seventh time, I went to Captain's Mass. And instead of taking a stripe, instead of taking money, he said, I got an idea. He said, how about if you take everybody's duty for 90 days? And that is opening up and closing up. He said, I'm sure you'll get to sleep pretty early, you know, if you work all day and get off at 8 o'clock at night. It worked. I did everybody's duty for 90 days. Wasn't late again. You know, kind of straightened up. I'm still doing what I wanted to do, you know, over there. Hitting the pubs a lot, you know, doing a lot of drinking. Nobody that I worked with knew exactly how much I was drinking. You know, my girlfriend over there, she knew because she was with me. We were both doing the same thing. I ended up getting ready to leave them. And after 3 years, okay, it's time to go. So I picked a duty station in San Diego. The day that I was supposed to leave, I went out, well, not the day, the day before I was supposed to be, I went out with the senior chief and the lieutenant commander and other people from my department drinking. And I ended up with the lieutenant commander and senior chief that evening, that night. And they say, okay, we're going to drop you off at the house, at your home, at the barracks. You go back to the barracks, get you some sleep. Call me when you get to the airport. I said, all right. My flight left at 8 o'clock, and I woke up at 5 after 8. So, you know, I called, and the senior chief said, were you at the airport? And the senior chief overslept. And he just started laughing. He said, come on in. So they sent me to PSD to get another flight out. They said, don't be late. I was almost late the next day. You know, I get home and my mom asked me, you know, when I'm home, and she asked, she said, she said, so you got all, you got a lot of pictures and stuff, right? From when you were over there in London, all that stuff, they got, there's a lot of history over there. Where are your pictures? And I came up with a lot. Oh man, I sent them with my household goods to San Diego. I'll send you some pictures when I get back there. Truth be told, with all the history that was over there, and I was over there for 3 years, I never took one picture, but I drank plenty of them. Yeah, I drank plenty of them. You know, I had to tell her that was a lie. You know, anyway, I get to San Diego, man, and I found some people that were just like me. I get to San Diego, I'm at the barracks, and I decide to take a walk, and I'm walking along the beach, man, and I smelt it. You know, went up my nose, and I've seen some people, and I asked them, you know, and I asked them, were they in the military, and they were like, you know, thought I was probably the police or something. They were like, no, you know, and I said the right word. You know, one of the words that we used to use, even when I was in high school, to find out if somebody was getting high or whatever, was asking, are you thorough? So I said, are you thorough? Oh, yeah. Come on, man, shoot, we good. You know, and I should have known better right then that I was getting in with the wrong people. But, you know, they were my people. I wasn't there in San Diego a full year before I got busted on my first drug test. And they told me I can drink. You can drink as much as you want to drink. You know, do you have a problem? Well, when they said, when I went to this little NASAP meeting that they had, you know, I'm thinking, I'm in here for marijuana. I'm not here for drinking. You know, so this don't apply to me. So I go back to my command, and within 90 days, I get busted on my second one. Still, you know, well, let me tell you about the first one. The first one, I agreed with them that if you let me stay in, I'll do a urine analysis 6 months, one every month for 6 months, and I'll be clean. And I was. On number six, I was clean. Everything was good. Me and my roommate went out partying. Head down in Imperial Beach, and I get back to work, and they drug test me again, and I was dirty again. Now they say, you got to go. So, you know, I go to Captain's Mass, and they asked me, they said, so, you know, you did the 6 months. So, you know, you worked that out. So what are you going to do now? And I said, I don't know. And they said, well, we're going to discharge you. And I said, well, if you discharge me, you know, that wouldn't be a good thing to do. And they asked me why. And I told them, I said, you know, if you discharge me, I'm going to tell the Russians everything I know. Yeah. They laughed about that too. Yeah. Because they asked me, what do you know? All I know is I got a top secret clearance. That's all I know. Anyway, they put me out. I called home and I told my mom. I got honest with her. I told her why. Told her they put me out. And I told her, I said, Mom, I said, I'm going to stay out here in California. You know, if I don't call, don't worry about me. I'm all right. If I call, start worrying. For the next 10 years, I never called or wrote. So I didn't know if my mom was alive or dead or, you know, or what, you know. But what happened was I got in trouble. In, I think it was 1992. Me and my girlfriend got to arguing, and there was a gun in the house. And she went for the gun, and I went for the gun, and I beat her to it. And I said, I'm gonna throw the gun away, because I didn't want it in the house anyway. So I go down to the ocean, man. I take the clip, I throw the clip away, throw the bullets away. And I put the pistol in my hoodie. And I'm walking back down the street, and there's the police. And they stopped me, and they asked me, are you Lee? And I told them, yeah. And they said, where's the gun? And I said, I threw it in the ocean. He said, oh, yeah? He said, okay. So they patted me down and everything, and, you know, didn't find the gun. And, you know, I'm talking to the guy. Now, I knew the officers because I managed the nightclub there also down in California for 10 years. You know, the whole time I was there, I was managing the nightclub, and I was a police liaison whenever we had trouble in the club. So they knew me. And I told the guy, I said, look, man, I don't want no trouble. I said, I'll tell you where the gun is. He said, where's the gun? I said, it's in my hoodie. And he arrested me for carrying a concealed weapon. You know, and he said, man, we got to do this. And he said, you're not going to stay in long, but we got to arrest you for it. They arrested me. I went to court probably about 30 days after that. I did a plea bargain. They gave me 3 months probation, $150 fine, and 5 days community service. And when they told me what the community service was, I'm not doing that. That you don a orange jumpsuit, they give you a trash bag, and you go along Interstate 5 picking up trash for 5 days. Nah, I'm not going to do that. So what did I do? I called home. And I talked to my nephew who answered the phone. I didn't know I had a nephew. And I asked him, I said, how old are you? He said, 9. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, who's home with you? And he said, Granny. And I said, tell Granny it's Lee. And my mom came to the phone. She was so thrilled because they had been looking for me for the last 10 years. You know, I've had a sister that came out there looking for me. They didn't call the police. They didn't call the morgue trying to find me. I had sent my mom the address where I was working at. You know, she didn't find it until after I got back home. Anyway, man, I come back here, and I really mean this, that if my mom knew what she was sending for, she probably wouldn't have sent for me to come home. Just she missed me so much, you know, because I came back in, I brought my disease here back here with me. And like a good alcoholic, man, I could find a job, You know, they would tell me, oh, ain't no jobs here. Ain't no jobs here. And I found a good job working at Park 500 in Hopewell. I did that. I worked that job for about 5 months. And then I got a job, a better job, working for Chesapeake County Public Schools as a tutor monitor. The only bad part about that was, you know, when I got that job, you know, I started using another substance, and it took everything from me, you know, it wouldn't let me spend money on alcohol, none of that. And I'm gonna tell you why that happened. I took a bunch of kids up to Pennsylvania to a camp up there. And when we got back, man, I was sitting on the porch and everything was just fuzzy. I couldn't see nothing, you know. My baby toe was numb, you know. My mom, being a nurse and a diabetic, I told my mom that something's going on. And I told her, I said, my baby toe's numb. I can't hardly see. My aunt lived right across the street. I said, I can't even see her house number. And she said, so when you drink water, are you still thirsty? I said, yeah, it runs right through me. She said, well, you probably need to go see your doctor. So I went to see my doctor and found out I was a diabetic. And the first thing he asked me while I was sitting there, he said, how much you drink? He said, you drink? And I said, once in a while. He said, how much? Of course, I did. I lied. You know, one or two beers. I only drank on the weekend, which was a lie. You know? And he said, you have to stop drinking. Oh, you can't drink nothing. And I'm like, huh? He said, alcohol, being a diabetic, alcohol is poison for your body. He said, you cannot drink any alcohol. Now, sitting there, I flashed back to my buddy, Bucky, Raymond Langston. I seen him walking down the street one day, and he told me, he said, man, they done cut my toe off. And I asked him why, and he told me why. You know, he said the doctor told him to start drinking. He didn't stop, so they cut his toe off. And then my brother told me that they cut his foot off. Then they cut his leg off, and he died because he wouldn't stop drinking. So I'm sitting there when the doctor told me I had to stop drinking. This thing here that's been trying to kill me for all those many years came up with another solution. You can use alcoholic, that white stuff. And I started using that stuff, man. And it took over everything. The bad part about that, working at this school, I'm getting it from, it's an alternative school, and these kids are in the middle school, so I'm getting it from their brothers and all that. So now when I go to school, man, and I'm walking on eggshells because these kids, I know they're going to tell, and I can't, you know, I can't hold them accountable. If I do, they're going to tell on me, and, you know, and I was in a real pickle, man. I really was. Didn't make no difference because my mom passed away in 97. In February of 97, I was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was riding with one of my buddies and we got pulled over by the police and they found paraphernalia on me. And the guy, he looked at me, he said, don't I know you? He said, you work at the school, don't you? Yeah. And he said, look, let me talk to you. He said, man, we can help you out, but you're going to have to help us. They wanted me to make some buys and give them names, and I wouldn't do that. They said you had until Tuesday to make your mind up. And I go to school Monday, nothing. Tuesday, they show up at the school with the dogs, running the dogs through the school. And then they go in the principal's office, and she calls me in. And they told her, you know, we're just trying to get them to help us. And I couldn't do it. I said, I can't do it. And They sent me for a drug test. I knew I was dirty. I go for a drug test. I go home, write a handwritten resignation letter, and I gave it to the bus driver that morning. Can you get that to Ms. Burns? And I resigned. I got put out of the put out of my mom's house by my brother. My brother put me out of the house. And I ended up in a homeless shelter, man, over there in Petersburg. Now, I always landed on my feet because I found a job working at the Ramada Inn. And I lost that job because I was selling rooms to the dope boys for dope. Sorry about that, but that's, you know, that's what I did. One of my sisters passed away, and she left an insurance policy, and I got $33,000 out of that insurance policy. I got it in August. No, got it in July. By August, I didn't have two nickels to rub together. You know, and I was still working at the Ramada Inn. So now I'm homeless again. I ended up in a homeless shelter, man. And I'm still doing the same thing. I'm working day labor, getting $35 a day, you know, just out of my mind over there. Plus I ran. So the police, Chester County Police, was looking for me. And it don't help to have a brother that's a Petersburg police officer. So they went to him and they told him, they said, look, we need to find your brother. You know, and he went to my other brother. And he said, man, now, Robert, you need to find Lee and tell him you need to go turn yourself in. Finally, I did, man. I went and turned myself in and stayed in jail for 3 days. They let me out, went to court, and I got off with misdemeanor accessory after the fact. You know, plus, you know, the police officer said, well, he done lost everything. They Ms. Burns, the principal, went to bat for me. He done lost everything. Can you guys give him a break? You know, so I didn't have any charges. I just had accessory after the fact. I walk out the courthouse, man, and I get back with these people that I'm using with, and I said, they couldn't do nothing to me. You know, I'm Lee. They couldn't do nothing. They didn't have no evidence. Just out of my mind. Anyway, I'm in this homeless shelter, man, and they told me, said, if you come in one more time lately, we're going to have to put you out of here. Sure enough, the next day I came in late. And I knew I was late. I wasn't just late. It was almost 9 o'clock at night that I was late. And I made a deal. I'm walking down the sidewalk, man. And I said, God, if you allow them people to let me in tonight, I'll do something about what I'm going through. I didn't know what, but that's what I said. And I go up and I knock on the door. The guy came to the door and he looked at me and just shook his head. He said, man, I didn't give your bed away. So I went back to my bed, man, and I hit my knees and I asked God to take me out of this. I wasn't asking to get me sober, mind you. I was asking him to let me go in my sleep so I didn't have to feel the pain. Because when I was working at the Ramada Inn, and I wish the lady would have told me, like, she's told me, she said, when you get sick and tired of being sick and tired, you're going to do something different. I wish she would have told me, when the pain get great enough, you're going to do something different. Because the pain was already great. It was, you know, and I was still doing the same thing. So when I said that prayer, man, it wasn't 3 days that the lady from the day ran the shelter, she called me in. She said, look, if you see this guy, tell him I need him to come back. And I seen the guy and I told him, he said, nope, not going back. And I asked him, I said, what do you mean? What's going on? He said, well, I told him I had a serious drug and alcohol problem. They found a place for me. And he said, I'm not trying to go up there with all them hillbillies. And I said, what? I said, where are they trying to send you? He said, Kentucky. I couldn't wait to run back and tell that lady that he didn't want to go. And she said, I did what I could do. And I said, I'll go. And she asked me why. And I said, because I've been using in this shelter for almost a year and a half. And I've had all these people in here scared to tell who it is. And she called the guy that was trying to catch me, who I knew he was trying to catch me. She called him in and she asked him, has somebody been using in this shelter? And he said, yeah, I'm getting close to catching him. And she said, ain't no need. He's sitting right there. And he said, no wonder. No wonder. You know, so I ended up in Louisville, Kentucky, man. Now, on the bus, on the way to Louisville, man, I was asleep. And something woke me up. And what I heard was, I'm sending you there so you can come back and help my people. Now, mind you, it was a couple of days before since I had gotten high. So I was like, okay, I don't know. Okay, leave that alone. Anyway, I get to Kentucky, man. And the guy asked me, he said, when the last time you used? And I told him about 2 weeks ago. So they sent me over to the program. And I went to my first meeting on August 22nd, and it was a 6:30 meeting at the Healing Place. And I went to that meeting, man, and I said, when I wake up tomorrow morning, that's going to be my sobriety day, August 23rd. I got in with the guys, man, and I started asking, so what do we do? And they said, just follow the crowd, man. So I started following the crowd. One guy told me, he said, look, when we go that way, you go that way. When them other guys go that way, they won't be coming back to the Hill Place tonight. So I stuck with these guys, you know, the whole time. And took me a minute to get a sponsor. I found the guy. I heard this guy tell my story. He played football. He ended up tearing his knee up. He played for the Atlanta Falcons. And I heard his story, and I seen him, and I asked him, Dion, my name is Lee, and I need a sponsor. And he said, all right, man. He said, I'll be your temporary sponsor. And I was like, temporary. He said, now, I need you to call me. He gave me his number and said, I need you to call me, you know, and we'll talk about it. Well, since he was going to be a temporary sponsor, I didn't call him. Couple of days later, I seen him on property, man, and I looked at him. He said, Lee, right? I said, yeah. He said, you didn't call me. I said, because I'm not looking for a temporary sponsor. He said, oh, yeah? I said, yeah. He said, okay, let's get busy then. And we went through the steps, man, and, God got a funny, you know, he's kind of funny sometimes. My first sponsor, Dion, was an associate pastor. I wasn't looking for an associate pastor, but I joined the Church of Christ with him. And it seemed like every Sunday the preacher was preaching to me. And then one day he told me, he said, man, I need you to leave the Healing Place. I need you to move into our house. So I decided I was going to leave the church. And I told Dion, I said, man, I got to leave the church, man. And he said, if you leave the church, you need to find you another sponsor. Okay. So, you know, the program, like I said, I worked all the steps, you know, and I'm trying to do the deal. And the program, there's so many guys there that was put into my life. And I went to a guy named Kenny, and I talked to him. I told him about it. He said, man, he said, no, that's not right. He said, Lee, it's probably time for you to get you another sponsor, really. So I had a home group at that time, and I've been watching this guy, man, you know, Ron, he was doing the deal. And I asked Ron, would he sponsor me? And he said, sure. And again, he said, are you willing to go through the 12 steps again? And I said, yeah. So we went through the 12 steps again. You know, every Saturday, I ended up at his house Saturday morning, and we went and worked the 12 steps, you know. And he told me, he said, man, I'm gonna show you how we stay sober here. We're going to do some service work. They used to have this, they might still have it, this meeting every 3 months called a quarterly. And it's like 500-600 people there. And I get there, and I'm there with him. And he said, hey, man, you see those chairs right there? You need to start putting those chairs out. I said, huh? He said, yeah, you need to start putting those chairs out. That's service work. So I started putting the chairs out, and I'm thinking, I'm going to put 500 chairs out by myself? Right? And I asked him, I said, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to go over and have a coffee with the old timers. So they sitting down having a cup of coffee, and he's looking at me while I'm working. Well, it was okay. Got all the chairs put out. Some other guys came in and helped, and then we had several guys help put them up. You know, and he told me, he said, man, it's time for you to start sponsoring guys. And I got a couple of sponsees, man. I started taking them through the steps. I got a job working at the Healing Place, working in the detox and in the overnight. And then a guy came up to Kentucky from Richmond. And he asked, he said, look, would you be willing to move back to Virginia to help open up the Healing Place in Richmond? And I said, yeah. So we came up here in, I think it was late 2004, something like that. And we started working on the Healing Place, getting it open. We opened up in 2005. By what, March of 2005, I had gotten fired, you know. I didn't like that, you know. But I didn't realize this also. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because I came here in good health, relatively. I ended up with a blood clot in my left leg. Didn't know where it came from, didn't have an injury. You know, doctor said it was from smoking. Could have been, but it could have been from smoking and the stress of that job, man, because, you know, what I know now is when you can't change something, you just got to go along with the flow. Sometimes that's not a good deal. That's not good for you, you know, especially if you know that it's wrong. You know, I know that bringing high-powered sedatives and stuff into a recovery scene, and I'm not a nurse or a doctor, right, and I got to issue this stuff out, that's not a good move, you know. So, you know, I was really against that. And anyway, I got fired, man. And I called my sponsor and I told him, I said, man, they fired me. He said, good, I didn't want you working there anyway. I hung up on him because I didn't want to hear that, you know. And I called John. Some of you guys know John P. I called John and I told him, I said, man, I'm ready to do some more step work. And he asked me, he said, did you get drunk? I said, nope. He said, so what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to do what the program alcoholics taught me to do, find a new job. And I found another job, man. I found a job working at the hospital. And I was only making $9 an hour, but hey, it beats the blank. You know? And I was going to a lot of meetings, man. I was meeting a lot of people, you know. I think when I was going through that, I met you guys down at Sandbridge, you know. Man, this, you know, I was learning the program, you know, and I learned what to do. And my buddy Ernie always told me, said, man, look, watch people, man. People are going to show you what to do and what not to do. I get to Richmond, man, and people were showing me exactly what to do, stay clean and sober, service work, you know. And like my sponsor told me, when you get to Richmond, find your home group. He said, trust God, clean house, and help others, man. He said, man, Lee, I guarantee if you do those things, man, you're going to stay sober, you know. And, you know, I've been trying to add and showing some of my sobriety ever since, man. You know, somebody asks me to do something, I do it. You know, take meetings into the treatment centers, take meetings into the prisons, I'll do it. You know, somebody, one of the guys asked him, so why you bring meetings into the prison? Well, because that's where I should have been. And some of the stuff I was doing, I should have been locked up. I remember I took a meeting into a treatment center, man, and I was sharing a little bit of my story. And I talked about getting arrested twice, you know, 3 days and 4 hours. And this guy jumps up out of the meeting. He said, you're nothing but a common criminal. I'm not listening to this. And he got up and walked out the meeting. And I thought to myself, if you'd have heard some of the stories of some of these other people in here, I said, no. You would have looked at me and said, oh, you're a saint, you know? So, you know, but like I said, man, this program, man, has taught me, you know, that if I stay, you know, keep my feet moving, stay put, I can stay clean and sober. If I try to help people, man, on a daily basis, you know, that trust God, clean house, and help others, you know, that's our code. That's what we do, you know? I got to Richmond, man, and I'm at the healing place. One of the first things I had to do was find meetings, AA meetings, you know. And I was asking these guys. Most of the people that worked there, they did another fellowship. And they were like, y'all, come to our meeting. And I'm like, if I have to, I said, but I'm looking for AA meetings. And they couldn't understand why I was looking for AA meetings. I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to, you know, treat people, taught me how to say yes, taught me how to say no when it was wrong, you know, and just, you know, enjoy life, man. I had to make a lot of amends, you know, to a lot of people. You know, one of the things that I told my first sponsor, that I'll be honest with you. What I told my second sponsor, I'll be honest with you. What I told John Pine, I'll be totally honest with you, you know, even if it makes me feel that big. I said, because if I don't be honest with you, I'm going to go back out and drink, you know, and I know that. And for me to go back out and drink, I'm going to go back out and start using, you know. And then I will end up in prison or dead, you know. Jails, institutions of death, that's where we end up at, you know. You know, last thing I'm going to say, man, is I had a friend here. This guy, man. I had asked him to be my sponsor before, and he had to go out of the country. And I told him I had to get me a new sponsor because, you know, I was doing some dangerous things here, and he was out of the country. Me and him, we remained real good friends, man. And I found out I had a brain tumor in 2012. And I told him, and he stayed with me took me to the hospital, you know, when it was time for the surgery. We prayed together, you know, and he told me, he said, man, he said, just trust God, Lee. Trust God. He said, everything's going to be all right. He said, I'll see you when you come out of surgery. And they went up through the roof of my mouth and my nose and pulled that tumor out. And I always tell people, they pull a little bit too much out because sometimes I forget things. Yeah. But yeah, now I'm in good health. But that guy, man, you know, I was able to be with him, you know. He would die. He got a cancer diagnosis, and he got the treatment, and he thought it was gone. And then it found its way back, and I was able to be there with him for the last month of his life, you know. And I miss that guy. You know, he taught me how to treat people, man, because I tell people this. I'm sorry, Bill. I tell people this. I never seen him angry. And all the time I've known him, I've known him about 20-something years. I never seen him angry. I seen him mad, but I never seen him angry. And he always, always left the door open for people that hurt him to come back inside that door. You know, he always had forgiveness in his heart for people, man. He taught me that, you know, no matter what. Forgive people, enjoy life, you know. If you're in here and you're struggling or you don't know what to do, just keep doing what you're doing, man. Come to meetings. Somebody will say something that sticks out to you. You know, somebody will. They did it for me. So thank you. I appreciate you guys allowing me to come here. Blue Ridge Speaker Group. Billy, thanks for asking me. You know, sorry I went over. Yeah. Love you guys.